Secret societies unveiled, the evil purpose behind them exposed. Obtainable from the Britain's Publishing Society, 40 Great Ormond Street, WC1. Introductory note. The object of this treatise is to show what an important part secret societies in general, and Freemasonry in particular, have played in the advancement of the Jewish plot for world domination. The secret society movement dates from before the Christian era. English Freemasonry, which was formally established in 1717 AD, is merely one of the lineal descendants of that age-old movement. The veil of Freemasonry behind which the promoters of this scheme work is, as Dr. Isaac M. Wise has stated in the Israelite of America of 3rd August 1886, quote, "A Jewish institution whose history, degrees, passwords, and explanations are Jewish from beginning to end." Thinking men, ever since the war, have been asking themselves what it is that disconcerts all measures for peace between the nations. Even a concourse of delegates from many strong nations meeting together to establish peace by agreement feel that the ground on which they stand is undermined. That feeling of insecurity is so intense that the delegates spend much of their time in and out of their meetings, assuring themselves and each other that they intend to stand by their covenant. Their fidelity to a covenant would go without saying, and would be an understood thing in ordinary circumstances. But the circumstances are not ordinary. Their tremblings are really justified, but most of them do not know why. If they will read this paper, they will make acquaintance with the power that causes them so much perturbation. It is that power, operating in a large extent through Masonic channels, that keeps the governments of the world in a state of permanent unrest. It is the power of the Jews. The writers of this treatise have drawn freely upon Mrs. Nesta Webster's, quote, "secret societies and subversive movements." They tender their thanks to that talented writer for collating such valuable information on this sinister subject. Mrs. Webster's book should be in the possession of all who are seeking knowledge on the causes of world unrest. It is published by the Boswell Publishing Company, 10 Essex Street, Strand, London. The evil purpose behind secret societies. There are some secret societies whose purpose is harmless. They, however, do not come within our survey. We are concerned with the long series of secret societies of Jewish origin that had its beginnings in the 1st century A.D., and had behind it the definite purpose of subverting all religions, except the Jewish religion, and debauching the minds of men, especially the leaders of men, so that they might lose their power to govern themselves decently. The idea was that, in that condition, they would come under the control of an outside power, the power that conceived this method and this purpose, the Jewish power. Starting with the Gnostics of the 1st century A.D., we trace their poisonous taint through a long list of secret societies. The Ophites, the Cainites, the Carpocratians, Manichaeans, Ismailis, Carmathites, Fatimites, and Assassins. Carmathites, rather. Then this evil movement was carried from the east to the west. The Knights Templar brought it to France and England, having been thoroughly debauched themselves by the Assassins in Syria. Other Gentile agents brought it to other parts of Europe, where it produced such evil bodies as the Bogomils, the Albigenses, and the Satanists. In the 16th century, we arrive at the Rosicrucians, who were the chief actors in the formation of English Grand Lodge. In the rituals of the higher degrees of Freemasonry, we find the prime purpose from which we started firmly established, and that purpose is the destruction of Gentile church and Gentile state. The Jew regards, or pretends to regard, anti-Semitism as the outcome of diseased or ill-informed minds. But we cannot admit that the encyclicals and other pronouncements of the popes of the Roman Catholic Church are the outcome of diseased minds. In them we find some very plain speaking by many of the popes, notably by Leo XIII and Pius VII. The latter knew what he was talking about when he said, quote, "They, the Jews, brazenly defend lustful excesses. They teach that it is lawful to assassinate those who betray their secrets, and to stir up sedition against kings and other rulers." Pius IX very properly reprobated those who hold the view that Freemasonry, is only a harmless institution, and that there is nothing to fear from it. As per Cahill's Freemasonry and the Anti-Christian Movement, pages 122 and 124. The most frequently quoted secular authority on the reality of the Masonic hidden power is Disraeli. Referring to the French Revolution of 1848, he said, quote, "It was neither parliaments nor populations, nor the course of events that overthrew the throne of Louis Philippe. The throne was surprised by the secret societies, ever prepared to ravage Europe." That was in 1852. In the House of Commons on July 14, 1856, he said, quote, "It is useless to deny, because it is impossible to conceal, that a great part of Europe, the whole of Italy and France, and a great portion of Germany, to say nothing of other countries, is covered with a network of these secret societies. And what are their objects? They do not want constitutional government. They want to put an end to ecclesiastical establishments." Mrs. Webster's Secret Societies and Subversive Movements, page 4, and Lord George Bentinck, chapter 27. Bentinck, rather. Apologies. In other words, they require the destruction of church and state. And again, speaking at Aylesbury in 1873, he said, quote, "We must take into consideration secret societies who can disconcert all measures at the last moment, who have agents everywhere, determined men encouraging assassinations, and capable of bringing about a massacre at any given moment. Now let us get down to detail. The early Jews had their secret philosophy called the Kabbalah. It had existed before their time, and the rabbis, quote, adapted it. In their hands, it was mingled with barbaric superstitions, sorcery, and so-called magic, and its nature was Judaized. In the book of the Kabbalah called the Zohar, we find the origin of the idea that the Israelites are a chosen people. They claim that they sprang from the supreme man, whereas the rest of mankind sprang from the supreme devil. That accounts for the peculiar racial psychology of the Jews. The creed of the Kabbalah was carried forward into the Talmud, the Jews' latter-day Bible. There we find their racial superiority insisted on. Let us quote, where it is written, 'Thou shalt not do injury to thy neighbor,' it is not said, 'Thou shalt not do injury to a Gentile.' If a Jew killeth a Gentile, he is not responsible." And again, we observe from the Talmud, quote, "On the house of the Gentile, one looks as on the fold of cattle." Imagine, then, the indignation of this superior people when Christianity came and stood in their path and was accepted by the nations. Something had to be done about it, and accordingly the destruction of Christianity and all other Gentile religions and all Gentile states became the supreme object to be pursued to the bitter end, even if it took, as it has taken, centuries to accomplish. In this one-sided campaign, only the most subtle and underhanded methods would be of any use. By encouraging the baser instincts of the Gentiles, their moral strength would be undermined, their revolutionary tendencies would be developed, and they would contribute to their own downfall. Secrecy, therefore, was essential, and behind that screen could be worked a system of misrepresentation, demoralization and perversion, all leading to destruction. Secrecy of the secret societies, misrepresentation of facts, demoralization of character, and perversion of religious faiths and scriptures, all leading to the subversion of the whole Gentile structure of civilization, its churches and its states. In order to trace the working of this scheme up to the present day, we will start in the 1st century AD and take special note of a sect called the Gnostics, from whom flowed other sects, all promoters of vice and corruption. We are told that the founder of Gnosticism was a Jewish magician named Simon Magus. And we learn from a high Freemason, Ragon, that the Gnostics were, quote, born of the Kabbalists. The secret scheme which the Gnostics built up on this Jewish foundation was a jumble of theosophy, occultism, magic, sorcery, and incantations. In fact, Kabbalism. The trouble they took to issue corrupt versions of the Gospels of St. Matthew, St. Luke, and St. John showed that one of their methods was perversion. They had perverted their original Bible by introducing the Talmud, and in their Gnostic movement, they were trying to pervert the Christian scriptures. Mrs. Webster, who is a high authority in these matters, said, quote, "The role of the Gnostics was to reduce perversion to a system by bringing men together into sects, working under the guise of enlightenment, in order to obscure all recognized ideas of morality and religion. It is this which constitutes their importance in the history of secret societies." Eliphas Levi, another authority, said that under the pretext of, quote, "spiritualizing matter," they had materialized the spirit in the most revolting ways, substituting the mystical license of sensual passions in place of moral law. So, in the first secret society which we have examined, we have found, 1, Jewish Kabbalism, 2, perversion of the scriptures, and 3, demoralization and debauchery. One sect of the Gnostics, the Ophites, worshipped the snake because he had revolted against God in the Garden of Eden. Here we have the worship of evil for evil's sake. Another sect of Gnostics, the Cainites, worshipped Cain, Dathan and Abiram, the men of Sodom and Gomorrah, and Judas Iscariot. They seem to have been specialists in the choice of evil things to worship. It seems hardly necessary to add that both the Ophites and the Cainites committed every kind of infamy. Note that these facts are taken from Dean Milman's History of the Jews, Chapter 2, page 491, Volume 2, page 491, rather, and E. de Fay's Gnostique et Gnosticism, page 349. We ask the reader to take particular notice of the Carpocratian secret society of Gnostics of the 2nd century, because they furnish an important link in the chain of subversion. They obliterated all idea of God by deifying humanity. Humanity became its own God. Coming forward to the present day for an example of this, we find this system established in the Talmud. Baruch Levi, writing to Karl Marx, said, quote, "The Jewish people taken collectively will be its own Messiah. Thus will be realized the promise of the Talmud, that when the times of the Messiah are come, the Jews will hold under their keys the properties of all the peoples of the world." That idea of a deified people was put into practice at any rate as far back as the 2nd century by the Carpocratians. The people thus deified might have been expected to set in a godlike fashion, to act, rather, in a godlike fashion. But the opposite was the case. These Gnostics behaved like all the other Gnostics. That is to say, they indulged in every sort of vice. We now turn to the Manichaeans of Persia. As per Hastings' Encyclopedia of Religion and Ethics, and Webster, page 30. The Manichaeans flourished circa 216 AD, and were a sect founded by the Manes, alias Cubicus, Manes, rather, alias Cubicus, who evolved a system of Kabbalism, Zoroastrianism, and Gnosticism, evolved a system known as dualism, which recognizes the two principles of good and evil, and holds that humanity came from an evil source, the offspring of devils. This latter idea is found in the Kabbalah, which says that Adam cohabited with female devils, namely Lilith, and Eve with the serpent. Not a very edifying story, but interesting to us, as it follows the trail of the Jewish holy serpent running through the secret societies. Note that this is a reference to the treatise Bereshith, Folio 54. We now pass from Gnosticism of the perverted Jews to the Gnosticism of the perverted Muslims. The founder of the Ismaili sect was Abdullah ibn Mayyun. Mayyun, rather. Yes, that's right. The son of a Persian doctor. It was due to his knowledge of Gnostic dualism that he conceived the idea of making himself powerful by means of a secret society. He showed remarkable skill and cunning in carrying out that idea. He kept his initiates unknown to each other, and dealt with each one according to his personal idiosyncrasies. With the devout, there was religious fervor. With the mystics, there was mysticism. With others, there was magic and legerdemain, and so on. It was only to the select few that his ultimate purpose was revealed in its entirety. And what was his creed? That religion and morality were nothing but an imposture and an absurdity. Here again we find perversion and demoralization, salient features of these movements. As per Reinhard Dozy's Spanish Islam, pages 403 through 405. On the ground so carefully prepared by Abdullah, the Ismailis were destined to conquer a great part of Arabia under the leadership of a Persian Ismaili named Karmath, I believe. Webster, 38 through 40. The latter mobilized a powerful band of brigands who pillaged the country and massacred all opponents. In accordance with the Gnostic, dualistic creed, the Karmathites indulged in every form of immoral license. Next, we come to the Fatimite dynasty of the Muslim caliphs, AD 908 to 1171. The fourth caliph of that line, having embraced the Gnostic Ismaili creed, inaugurated in Cairo the first Grand Lodge. The doings of the sixth caliph are worth mentioning because in them we see some of the modern methods of secret society Freemasonry foretold. He had many degrees of initiation and kept the various classes of initiates unknown to each other. It was at the sixth degree that the proselyte was taught that religion was unnecessary. At the ninth degree, there was nothing left of morality to throw overboard. Von Hammer's History of the Assassins, pages 36 and 37. The Order of the Assassins, about 1090 AD, comes into our story because the Knights Templar, who introduced Eastern secret society methods into Europe, came into intimate contact with them. The founder of the Assassins was a free-thinking Persian Muslim named Hassan, a friend of the poet Omar Khayyam. Having adopted the Ismaili creed, and having drawn to himself some other proselytes, Hassan managed to establish himself as a sort of brigand in the mountains around Palestine. He had been to the Grand Lodge in Cairo and had learnt the Ismaili secret society movement thoroughly. He modified it to suit his special requirements. For instance, he made a pretense of being an Orthodox Muslim, and he made use of hashish. Hashish, a hempen drug with which he stupefied his early initiates and caused them to think that they had been in communication with the Prophet Muhammad, and that the latter had ordered them to take oaths to assassinate the opponents of their sect. Here we have murder organized on a basis of religious fervor. Mrs. Webster says that the system employed by Hassan was to a large extent the model on which all systems of organized murder, working through fanaticism, such as the Irish Republican Brotherhood, were based, and the signs, symbols, and initiations of the Grand Lodge of Cairo formed the groundwork for the great secret societies of Europe. We now come to the Knights Templar. This order was instituted in 1118 by 9 French gentlemen whose purpose was to protect pilgrims who visited the Holy Shrine in Jerusalem. They were bound by vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience. Their operations in Palestine brought them at first into unfriendly contact with the Assassins, but the chief of that order, who was known as the Old Man of the Mountains, set on foot some subtle negotiations, with the result that the Templars became closely intimate with the Assassins, as per Dr. Bussell's Religious Thought and Heresy in the Middle Ages, page 795. A French writer, Comte de Cantelieu, who had access to the archives of the Templars, said that a perusal of them showed that their association with the Assassins was really a sinister one. The Cause of World Unrest, Grant Richards, London, page 64. One of the knights, Guillaume de Montbard, was initiated into the order by their Grand Master, and his companions followed suit. The Assassins' creed was the Ismaili one. And grafted onto that was a ritual for rebuilding Solomon's temple. As the original members of the Assassin's Order were Muslims, and not interested in the rebuilding of Solomon's Jewish temple, it is clear that the order had been penetrated by a Jewish element. When the Templars imported this Gnostic Ismaili Judaic creed into Europe, an eminent Freemason, Clavel, showed that their organization corresponded closely with that of the Assassins, and had the same hierarchy of degrees. Their objects, too, were similar. Both conspired for the ruin of the religion which they professed in public. In 1305, Pope Clement V recalled the Templars to Europe to account for their misdeeds. Their leader, Jacques de Molay, arrived in France with 60 knights and large sums of money. They were tried on several charges, one of which was that they defiled their own religion, and another that they had practiced unnatural vices, a familiar feature of these Judaic secret societies. They were found guilty, and 54 knights and Jacques de Molay himself were burnt at the stake by order of the French king, Philippe le Bel. The Pope excommunicated the order, and in England it was suppressed. Now, please note that the Templars of that day had a grievance against the Church for having caused their downfall, and against the state for executing Jacques de Molay. This combined grievance gave the Hidden Hand a peg on which to hang a scheme of revenge. This was worked subtly into the rituals of the higher degrees of Freemasonry, until at the 30th degree, the candidate emerges a full-blown revolutionary, bound by oath to avenge Jacques de Molay and to subvert the state when called upon to do so. The ritual shows that these undertakings are meant seriously and not symbolically. The Templars were not the only importers of Eastern cults of evil into Europe. In the 9th century, a sect called the Bogomils, or Satanists, migrated from Syria and Mesopotamia into the Balkans. That is, from The Cause of World Unrest, forward page 62. They were Gnostic or Manichaean dualists. They said that God had two sons, Sataniel and Jesus. As the latter came down to earth and, according to their idea, failed in his mission, Sataniel, or Satan, was the stronger and should be worshipped. We need go no further. About 1180 AD, the name Albigenses was applied to a sect of dualists who had spread into France from Eastern Europe. Many of them were returned crusaders, and they had brought back from the East the same sort of taint as that which the Templars imported into Europe. During their sojourn in Bulgaria, the Albigenses earned the unenviable name of Bougre, or, as Isaiah would have expressed it, the people of Sodom and Gomorrah. They settled in France and the country round about Languedoc, which became known as, quote, the Judea of France, owing to the large number of Jews in their sect. So here again we touch dualism, Gnosticism, Kabbalism, and Jews, and, as usual, immorality. We have already described one sect of Satanism, the Bogomils of the 9th century. In the 15th century, another cult of Satanism arose. Eliphas Levy says that the essence of Satanism is desecration. Quote, it is requisite to profane the ceremonies of the religion one belongs to, and to trample its holiest symbols underfoot. A certain marshal of France, Gilles de Rais, having become a convert to Satanism, indulged in the most abominable debaucheries. In pursuit of the rites of black magic, he made holocausts of little boys and girls. Eliphas Levy says, quote, the Jews, the most faithful trustees of the secrets of the Kabbalah, were always the great masters of magic in the Middle Ages. And Voltaire says, quote, this ancient superstition comes from the secrets of the Kabbalah, of which the Jews call themselves the sole repositories. So here again we find the same root cause, the Jew and his Kabbalah. We now come to another highly important secret society, the Rosicrucians, or Order of the Rose Croix. Just as the Templars were the chief agents for importing the poison of Eastern secret societies into Europe, so the Rosicrucians were the chief agents, for implanting that poison into English Freemasonry. The doctrine of the Rosicrucians was a compound of Arabian and Syrian magic, and of Jewish Kabbalism, partly inherited from the Templars, but reinforced by direct contact with Kabbalistic Jews in Germany. Mirabeau, the great French revolutionary, who was well acquainted with these matters, said that the Rosicrucian order was merely that of the Templars, secretly perpetuated. This brings us to English Freemasonry. This came into existence in 1717, when the guilds of operative or working Masons allowed non-operative or speculative Masons to penetrate their lodges, and, in conjunction with them, to inaugurate English Grand Lodge. Guilds of working Masons had been in existence in some countries, for centuries, before 1717. They were societies working under secret conditions for the safeguarding of their professional, architectural interests. By their connection with old societies of the same sort, the English operative Masons had acquired the use of Jewish rituals and symbols, but they used them in a purely symbolic sense and were not Judaized by them. They had 3 degrees, entered apprentice, fellow craft, and master mason. And when Grand Lodge was formed, these degrees, modified so as to eliminate mention of the Christian God, were carried forward and formed the ritual, the sole ritual, of English Freemasonry, which was also known by the name of Craft Masonry, or Blue Masonry. But having bestowed their 3 degrees on English Freemasonry, the operative Masons faded away. They lost their Masonic identity. The speculative Masons became supreme. The particular secret society order which engineered the amalgamation and acquired control of English Freemasonry on behalf of Jewry was the Rosicrucian Order. The Jewishness of the whole affair is seen in the design of the coat of arms for the English Grand Lodge. It consisted of symbols purely Kabbalistic. Mr. Lucien Wolfe, a Jewish authority, or rather an authority on Jews, said that they belonged to the highest and most mystical domain of Hebrew symbolism. What possible use could English Freemasons have for these Judaic symbols? None, but they stand as witness of the continuity of grip which Jewry has applied to all secret society movements from the first century until the present day. Now let us return to the 3 craft degrees above mentioned. If English Freemasonry stopped there, it could claim to be altogether harmless, as there is nothing in those degrees to excite the English Freemason to become a revolutionary either against church or state. But beyond those degrees, there are others which were designed, purposely designed, to create the revolutionary spirit. When English Grand Lodge had been established, other Grand Lodges, or as they called them, Orients, were formed in the capitals of Europe, notably the Grand Orient of France. Also, there arose in our midst what is known as the Scottish Rite. All these institutions are revolutionary, as we shall see when we examine some of their rituals. But first, let us state that there is a difference of opinion among English Masons as to the recognized scope of English Masonry. Some regard Blue Masonry as the only orthodox ritual. Others hold that such, quote, higher degrees of the rites as have been barred by English Grand Lodge are permissible. A French Grand Orient has been barred, by English Grand Lodge, but there are others that have not been barred. The Scottish Rite has not been barred, and as it is typical of revolutionary Freemasonry, we will examine some of its rituals. And let us take note that many highly placed English Freemasons have been initiated into its highest degrees. The bulk of English Freemasons do not go beyond the Orthodox 3rd degree. They are therefore harmless. They are also ignorant of what lies beyond. They are ignorant that they themselves form a harmless link in a harmful chain. And yet, not altogether harmless. The watchful eye of Jewry can select from among these men certain special types who are suitable for initiation into the quote-unquote higher degrees. The process is a very subtle and gradual one. The candidate is not allowed to go far if he is found wanting in the right Masonic, i.e. revolutionary, spirit. Now for the higher rituals. We are quoting again from pages 57 to 62 of The Cause of World Unrest. In the 3rd degree, the candidate had already been told to do 2 things, to find a mysterious, quote, lost word, and to avenge the death of Hiram Abiff, Solomon's chief architect, who was murdered during the beginning of the temple, rather during the building of the temple. He is not destined to find the lost word until the 18th degree, but the affair of Hiram Abiff is disposed of in the 9th degree, when the candidate stabs a figure representing the murderer. In this degree, certain things are said to induce the candidate to adopt a revolutionary spirit. In the 11th degree, the candidate undertakes to become a, quote, governor in Israel. The next 3 degrees, the 12th, 13th, and 14th, are concerned with the rebuilding of Solomon's temple. In the 15th degree, the Jewishness of the whole affair, we are supposed to be describing English Freemasonry, keep in mind, is further indicated. The 70 lights in the lodge are said to allude to the 70 years of the Hebrew captivity, the Babylonian captivity, of course, and the candidate is made to say that he is traveling from Babylon to Jerusalem. His attention is again called the tyranny of kings. This gives a further fillip to his revolutionary tendencies. The 18th, the Rosicrucian degree, is of special interest to us because it was the Rosicrucians who took the chief part in founding the English Grand Lodge. We already know that they were a form of resuscitated Templars, and that one of their chief objects was the destruction of the quote-unquote church. To show how this is done, we will quote the Abbe Beruel, the leading authority on Jews and Masonry. Quote, "As soon as the candidate has proved that he understands the Masonic meaning, Igne natura renovatur integra, which translates as all nature is renewed by fire, from the Latin, of the inscription INRI, Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews, the master of the lodge exclaims, quote, my dear brethren, the word is found. All present applaud the luminous discovery that he, whose death was the consummation of the Christian religion, was no more than a common Jew crucified for his crimes. It is on the gospel and the Son of Man that the candidate is to avenge the brethren, the pontiffs of Jehovah. As per the World Unrest, Ante, pages 57 to 62. If the candidate is convinced by this, the first half of his Masonic education is complete. Let me read that again. If the candidate is convinced by this, I should say, the first half of his Masonic education is complete. He finds himself on the side of those who would subvert the church. There remains, however, another important object, and that is the subversion of the state. And we shall find this in the 30th degree. On the way, we pass the 27th, the Knights Templar degree. We have already described them historically, and we meet them again, Masonically, in the 30th degree. This is a very important degree because in its ritual, it exposes the trickery, the falsity of all that has gone before. Addressing the candidate, the master says, quote, my brother, you desire to unite yourself to an order which has labored in silence and secrecy for more than 500 years, with a single end in view, and with only partial success. The Order of the Knights Kadosh has for its mission the avenging of a great crime. Do you fully understand that this degree is not like much of so-called masonry, a sham that means nothing and amounts to nothing? That what you are engaged on is real, will require the performance of duty, will exact sacrifice, will expose you to danger, and that this order means to deal with the affairs of nations, and be once more a power in the world? The candidate then learns that the great crime which calls for vengeance is the execution of Jacques de Molay, see paragraph 22 of this treatise, whose order, the Templars, was excommunicated by Pope Clement V, and who was himself burnt at the stake by order of the French king in 1314. The candidate by this time is an adept in the idea of vengeance. First of all, it was Hiram Abiff, then the pontiffs of Jehovah, and then Jacques de Molay. He may not care two straws about the individuals, but they have served their symbolic purpose during a period when the virus of, quote, revolution has been instilled into his mind. He is now a full-blown revolutionary, an enemy of church and state, and bound by oaths to act when called upon. Now, as to the active use to which these men may be put, the skeptic may feel inclined to poo-poo the whole business as so much mummery, with only a pretended purpose behind it. But let us ask Disraeli whether this is the case. We have already quoted him in paragraph 7 of this treatise as saying, quote, we must take into consideration secret societies who can disconcert all measures at the last moment, who have agents everywhere, determined men encouraging assassinations, etc. Those agents, those determined men, have to be carefully selected, and we have just noted how they select them. We have seen that they are bound by oath to do those things which enable the hidden hand to, quote, deal with the affairs of nations, as stated in the ritual of the 30th degree. A little further on, we shall show how in 1789 they, quote, dealt with the affairs of the French nation. First, however, let us examine the events in connection with the assassination of the Archduke Franz Ferdinand, heir to the throne of Austria, in 1914. On the 15th of September, 1912, a Paris paper, Les Revues Internationales des Sociétés Secrètes, made the following statement, quote, "Perhaps light will be shed one day on these words of a high Swiss mason on the subject of the heir to the throne of Austria. He is a remarkable man. It is a pity he is condemned. He will die on the steps of the throne." 2 years later, the sentence passed on him by Freemasonry was carried out. From the shorthand notes of the trial, we obtain some interesting facts. Kabrinovic, one of the convicted murderers, gave evidence which proved conclusively the close connection between this murder and Freemasonry. He was himself a Freemason, and he upheld the villainous principle of revolutionary Freemasonry by saying, quote, "In Freemasonry, it is permitted to kill." Another murderer, Princip, the one who fired the fatal shots, denied, in a suspiciously confused manner, being a Freemason, but made statements that confirmed what Kabrinovic had said about the Masonic origin of this murder. He gave political reasons for his own share in it. In the 15th degree, we saw the intention of Freemasonry to remove kings and presidents. In the space of a very few years, the thrones of the following countries have, by some means or another, been emptied. France, Germany, Austria, Russia, Spain, Portugal, Turkey, Greece, and China. Is that nothing? Or is it just a series of coincidences? Turning from kings to presidents, we will mention the cases of Lincoln and Garfield. Abraham Lincoln had the temerity to frame a scheme for lending money to the American people without the help of the money power. That, of course, was not to be tolerated from any president, however eminent. He was assassinated. President Garfield also held what the Jews regard as obnoxious views on the subject of the money question. He said, quote, "Whoever controls the money of a nation controls that nation." He was assassinated. Benjamin Franklin, president of the state of Pennsylvania, would certainly have shared the same fate if he had lived 120 years later. In 1790, however, the Jews had not got fully into their stride in America. Otherwise, do you think they would have tolerated the following words of Benjamin Franklin? Quote, "In whatever country Jews have settled in large numbers, they have lowered its moral tone. They have depreciated its commercial integrity. And when opposed, have tried to strangle that country to death financially. They are vampires, and cannot live amongst themselves only. They must subsist on Christians and other people not of their race. If you do not exclude them from these United States in this Constitution, in less than 200 years they will have swarmed here in great numbers, so great numbers that they will dominate and devour the land. If you do not exclude them, in less than 200 years our descendants will be working in the fields to furnish them sustenance, while they will be in the counting house, rubbing their hands gleefully. I warn you, gentlemen, that if you do not exclude the Jews for all time, your children's children will curse you in your graves." Those words were spoken nearly 150 years ago. Today, we see the U.S. president writhing in the grip of the money power. Whether the American people are cursing the politicians who disregarded Franklin's appeal cannot appropriately be stated here. Now we deal with the great French Revolution of 1789. The ordinary Gentile of today, after reading the history of that revolution, remains stark staring ignorant of what forces were in play. He can see two parties only, the people who wanted a constitution, and the king, who was slow in granting it. Eventually, when the revolution was in progress, the king capitulated. There was then no reason for the continuance of the revolution. But a cessation of it did not suit the views of the Jews, who were hidden behind the secret societies. They had staged the whole affair, and they were going to run it their own way. The French people might come to an arrangement with the French king, but the power that can, as Disraeli puts it, quote, "disconcert all measures," did disconcert that measure. From that time forward, what happened was of a much bloodier nature than what had gone before. And who, you may ask, were the hidden powers' chief agents in that affair? They were the Jacobin clubs, drawn from the lodges of French Freemasonry, and mobilized for war, secret society war, by a very secret society called the Illuminati, which had been suppressed in Bavaria shortly before the French Revolution. Transferring their activities to France, they created the Jacobin clubs. A high French Freemason, Jean Bon, deputy of the Seine, speaking in 1919, said, quote, "The Society of the Jacobins, which was the great author of the French Revolution, was only the exterior aspect of the, quote-unquote, Masonic Lodge." That is the same thing as saying, quote, "The authors of the revolution were Jews. The Masonic Lodge in France was created by Jews for purely revolutionary purposes." And what did the members of this hidden power want to achieve? They wanted to kill the French king and to ram the poisonous doctrine of liberty, equality, fraternity down the throats of the French people. They succeeded in both these objects. They played with the leaders of the French people as one plays with puppets. They caused them to do all the things necessary to bring their own king to the scaffold. They caused them to adopt the slogan of liberty, equality, fraternity, and thus laid the foundations of all Latter-day Socialist and... all Latter-day Socialist and Communist propaganda. But even today, the politicians of England and France cannot see the purpose which is hidden behind this slogan. They cannot see that communist Russia has no liberty, no equality, and no fraternity. They even allow the inventors of this false slogan to supplement it today by other ideas intended to fool the Gentile mind, such as anti-capitalism and pacifism, and other isms that play into the hands of the hidden power. Before leaving the First French Revolution, we desire to emphasize the fact that the power that could foment it and carry it through, as we have described, is a power to be respected and not to be ignored merely because it is hidden. That power is the power of the Jews. Now for the French Revolution of 1848. At that time, Europe was quiet, and there were no troubles on the surface. But underground, the Jewish mole was busy burrowing. The mole, as we know, throws up molehills, and Disraeli must have seen many of these appearing on the surface of the ground, when in 1844 he uttered a warning that a big revolution was brewing in Europe, quote, "entirely under the auspices of the Jews," as per his novel Coningsby, which was quite biographical in tone. In 1848, attempted risings took place in many of the chief towns of Europe, but it was chiefly on France that this Jew-controlled secret society effort fell. France was fated to have another king dethroned, and much Gentile blood was shed at the bidding of the Jews. What makes this event specially interesting to us is that the government which came into office as the result of this second French Revolution put into effect a system of state-controlled industry, which is the boasted aim of the British socialist leaders. The national workshop scheme, which would provide work or pay for all, was given a full chance to prove its feasibility, and it failed miserably. Its idealist promoters were ejected. The British socialists, under the guidance of the hidden power, whose puppets they are preparing a similar millennium, in quotes, for this country, imagining or pretending that their scheme is quite new, the product of their superior brains. When they get into power, they had better feather their nests quickly before a similar fate befalls their government. Perhaps that is what they intend. The modern representatives of the hidden power have been, and he's made a list here, the Illuminati, the Carbonari, the Haute Vente Romaine, or Alta Vendita, and the Alliance Israelite Universelle, or Universal Israelite Alliance. But by whatever names these bodies are known, they are all manifestations of the same Jewish power burrowing under the Gentile world. In 1918 to 1922, the mole-like character of this power was demonstrated in Germany. Defeated in the war, Germany was in great trouble, so up came the mole to take advantage of that trouble. The communists hailed it under the name of Spartacus, the pseudonym adopted by Weishaupt, the founder of the Illuminati. The German communists became Spartacists, and during a brief period of power, they played as much havoc as they could with Germany's affairs. We have now completed the trail of the Jewish serpent, or mole, from the early Kabbalists right through ancient, medieval, and modern secret societies to the present day. And from our own observations, we have confirmed Dr. Isaac M. Wise's definition, which we quoted in our introduction, that Freemasonry is an institution which is Jewish from start to finish. In the course of our narrative, we have proved conclusively that its purpose was destruction. Destruction of morals, destruction of church, and destruction of state. Another striking proof of the reality of the Jewish power is found in the case of Russia. The weakening of the morale of the Russian troops in the Great War gave Jewry one of those unique opportunities which it is so well capable of seizing. It seized this one, and a Christian people of 160 millions, and a country measuring one-sixth of the land surface of the world, fell into its hands. Russia, as we knew it, ceased to exist. It became a mass of humanity, a proletariat, terrorized over by an alien Jewish despotism. When that alien government came into power, it immediately, one might almost say instantaneously, showed its Kabbalistic, Gnostic, satanic origin by raising the banner of Antichrist. The Russian people could not raise a finger of protest, so tightly were they held in the grip of the Jews, known to the outer world as Bolshevists. It is not the purpose of this treatise to go into any detail about the manner in which the money power applies its tyrannical pressure, but we would like to quote the words of an eminent Zionist, Jabotinsky, who shows how the political control of a country may pass into the hands of an alien power when sufficient, quote, pressure has been applied to its ministers. He said, quote, "Zionism does not take no from an English official seriously. The opinions of governments are apt to alter under pressure." And again, quote, "There is only one power that really counts, and that is the power of political pressure. We are the mightiest nation in the world because we possess that power and know how to use it." From his World Service Address in Erfurt, Germany, 1-4-35. So January 4th, 1935, I believe it is. Did you know that, Mr. Reader? Perhaps not, but you may safely accept Jabotinsky's statement. Jewry has many ministers safely under lock and key. To the eyes of the world, they are free men, but in reality, they are puppets. The knowledge that something unpleasant will happen to them if they show any independence keeps them submissive. Even men of good family and ample means, in their efforts to obtain certain desirable but at the same time vulnerable positions, which they cannot obtain or keep without the sacrifice of honor, make the sacrifice. They become puppets, but there are also men of no birth, no education to speak of, and no means worth mentioning, who are pushed into Parliament and rise to political and perhaps ministerial office. Some of them become wealthy, much more wealthy than can be accounted for by their salaries or possible savings. How is it done? Ask the hidden hand. Now, Mr. Reader, we have dragged you along unaccustomed paths, and it is our duty to help you to summarize the extraordinary items of information which you have collected on the way. Do you know what you have done? You have isolated the microbe of a disease. What disease? Kindly refer for a moment to the third paragraph of our introductory note. There you learnt that the world is ill, and that the cause of this illness is totally inexplicable. It is not so very many years ago that the fundamental causes of many of our bodily diseases were inexplicable to the doctors. When, however, the sentence of bacteriology, rather the science of bacteriology, excuse me, came in and made them wise on amoebas and parasites, they marveled to think that such very small organisms could produce such very large effects. Continuing this bacteriological simile, you have tracked down the cause of world unrest and have isolated the microbe which produces it, that is, Parasitis judaicus. And what makes your discovery especially valuable is that you have also isolated the reason and motive for this microbe acting in this particular way. You have verified that reason in the deter- that reason, rather, in the determination of the leader of an ancient people to realize the position in this world which they believe was prescribed for them by their god, Jehovah. That idea of being a chosen people was not a new one. It was borrowed. The Egyptians had it before them. And here he cites Ehrman's Life in Ancient Egypt, page 32. But having borrowed it, the rabbis fostered it energetically and made it a real obsession in the minds of their people. If we look at their Orthodox Bible, the Old Testament, we see that obsession firmly established. It runs all through the historical part, continues in the books of the prophets, and finds its consummation in the 60th chapter of Isaiah, in which the whole Gentile world becomes subservient to Jewry. Verse 12 says, quote, "For that nation and kingdom that will not serve thee shall perish. Yea, those nations shall be utterly wasted." When we came to the Jews' second Bible, the Talmud, in our paragraph 15, we found the same idea carried forward, but with a different sort of climax. Jehovah was pushed on one side, and in his place the rabbis ordained that a deified people, Israel, should eventually become its own Messiah. The result to the Gentile nations, however, remains the same as before. So, in that grand objective, you isolated the reason for the unremitting efforts of Jewry to realize its supposed destiny. You also saw the reason for profound secrecy and for the use of underhanded methods, misrepresentation and perversion. Seeing that all secret societies are supposed to be, and try to be, really secret, it might be thought that investigators like ourselves have to guess at what lies behind the veil. But it so happens that the archives of at least two of the most important of all secret societies, that is, the Knights Templar and the Illuminati, were seized, and the objects and methods of those societies were exposed to public view. The same thing happened in the case of the Hungarian Revolution of 1918-19, which was conducted by a Jew named Béla Kun. From the papers seized in Hungary, we learn that at the Basel Jewish Congress of 1897, the Grand Master said, quote, "We must spread the spirit of revolt among the workers. It is they whom we shall send to the barricades, for we have need of their discontent to ruin Christian civilization and hasten anarchy. It is necessary that the moment arrive when the Christians shall come themselves and implore the Jews to take control. Instead of imploring the Jews to take control, it would be much better for the Gentiles to implore themselves to sit up and use a little common sense. In numbers, they are over 100 to 1. Are the 100 going to ask the 1 to govern them because they are too stupid to govern themselves? As regards the workers, the Jews say that they have need of their discontent. They therefore foster it so that the workers may themselves create that condition of anarchy which will engulf everything, including themselves. The workers do not know that at the far end of the channels of socialism and communism, along which they are being shepherded by the hidden hand, they are to meet, their political doom, in the same way the Russians met their own political doom. Now let us clinch the main point of our newly acquired knowledge. Without going so far as to say that all secret societies are necessarily evil, we can say, without fear of reasonable contradiction, that all the secret societies which had their origin in the Jewish scheme of world domination are not only evil, but perniciously and malignantly so. The peoples of the world have from time to time designed all sorts of deadly weapons with which to fight each other. The undermining of fortresses and military positions is a method practiced by all belligerents, but only in wartime. It has been left to the Jew to carry on a peacetime, quote, campaign, if that word can be applied to the case in which there is only one belligerent, in which the aggressor employs the undermining method from day to day, from year to year, and, like the Death Watch beetle, from century to century. The fortress to be reduced is the whole of the Gentile world, and more especially, that part of it which is of the Christian religion. The plan of campaign is, that is to say was and still is, to sap the moral and intellectual fibers of the Gentiles to such an extent that they lose their grip on their religions and other institutions. The aggressor then penetrates those institutions and causes them to fail. That has been the purpose of all the Jew-designed secret societies which we have examined. The demoralizing and stupefying of a large part of the human race. It has been so successful that the Jew, with the help of big money, which gives him financial, economic, and political domination, has nearly attained his purpose. Nearly, but not quite. Germany has led the revolt. If the other nations throw off their cloak of ignorance, the game will be up. In our introductory note, we undertook to introduce to the puzzled Gentile politicians the power that is responsible for their political perplexities. We have shown them the power which, with the help of Freemasonry, engineered all the big revolutions of modern times, starting from the great French Revolution of 1789 and including the Russian Revolution of 1917 to 1918. A power that can do that, and can also control the currencies and exchanges of the world, is the greatest power in existence. Or, we should say, in worldly existence. But who gives a moment's thought to that power when discussing the doings of the League of Nations, which is itself a Jewish institution? With the knowledge obtained from a perusal of this paper, the ordinary man is enabled to see the prime movers, hidden behind the screen of puppet politicians, who masquerade in the League of Nations as saviors of civilization. But they possess no real power. Their movements are directed by the hidden hand. End of text.